Chicago journalist Jamie Calvin about the police shooting of Laquan McDonald and its recent political fallout. Good night, Doug.
Good night, Jackie. Good night, Matt.
Good night, Matt.
Good night.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Thank you for listening to the Cable Evening News. I'm Sam Bowman. On October 20th, 2014, Laquan McDonald, a 17-year-old black man armed with a knife, was shot 16 times by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke in an industrial neighborhood on the southwest side. Over a year later, Van Dyke was charged with murder, the first Chicago police officer to be so charged for an incident that took place while on duty. The delayed indictment was due mostly to the evasive and opaque response of the city government and police department, which is an attitude as synonymous with Chicago as icy roads and deep dish pizza. The mainstream local media largely followed the city's line on the shooting, which was that Van Dyke fired only a few shots as McDonald approached him aggressively, and that McDonald died after being transported from the scene. However, pressure was kept on the city for over a year to release McDonald's autopsy report and dashcam video of the incident. The video was eventually released on November 25th of this year, hours after Officer Van Dyke was charged with murder, and the autopsy report was obtained as the result of a lawsuit brought by independent journalist Jamie Calvin, and it showed that McDonald was shot 16 times and died at the scene. Both pieces of evidence show a far different story than what had so far been made public, one that paints the city's version as an obvious cover-up and has inspired outraged protest in the city and across the nation. Many have called for Mayor Rahm Emanuel's political head, demanding that he resign. Others, however, see an opportunity for reform in Emanuel's administration. I spoke recently with Jamie Calvin, the journalist and activist who sued the Chicago city government for Laquan McDonald's autopsy report. He has been one of the most prominent voices calling for reform of the city's notorious police department for years. The full interview with Mr. Calvin can be found on KBOO's website, including discussion of his role in the case, who Laquan McDonald actually was, the role of the police union in investigations and media portrayals of police shootings, the sorry state of Chicago's news media in general, and the mood in Chicago as Mayor Emanuel hopes to defend his political legacy. As far as the political implications in Chicago, there are a lot of people have called for Mayor Emanuel and District Attorney Alvarez to resign. You in particular have said that that might not be the best idea.
This is in no way a defense of his handling of the Laquan McDonald case, which I think sure. was deplorable. And again, I think that I said earlier in our conversation that this problem doesn't exist apart from all of us. And that's not to, you know, have a kind of collective guilt that dilutes individual responsibility. That's not what I mean. I mean that it's, to me, a kind of, it's both a distraction, it's diagnostically wrong in terms of what the real problems are, and it's strategically unwise to focus all energy on the mayor, as if the resignation of the mayor would fix anything, and as if he was solely and centrally responsible for the conditions that led to the Laquan McDonald case. And, you know, I've been working on this stuff and investigating it for years. And so, you know, I know that the Emanuel administration came into office and it inherited a really toxic set of conditions, of cultural and systemic conditions within the police department. And this is not a case about the character of the mayor, which I don't have direct knowledge of, or the vision of the mayor. It's really a case about his circumstances. And so right now in Chicago, at the center of this huge and engulfing controversy, engulfing for his administration, is a very, very skilled political operative whose only way forward, is the only way for him to recover his his political viability and any possibility of a legacy is to do the right thing, and to really rise to the occasion and address these fundamental issues of police reform. I have no idea whether he's up to the challenge, but I think that is a more constructive course for the city. And I'm really, my objective is to see enduring reforms. I mean, we're really talking about saving lives here. There are changes that can be made, and some of them are, pretty obvious fixes that will save lives. So, it's going to be one of the great dramas in American political life in coming months and years to see. I don't want to suggest it's up to him alone, but he is an important, or potentially a really important, change agent going forward.
And what do you see as some of the basic reforms that could be implemented in Chicago?
For me, it's really, there are four core reform objectives. One, it has to do with transparency. The information just has to come out, and that is happening. My colleagues and I at the Invisible Institute made public last month a huge amount of data about the disciplinary histories of police officers, acquired through litigation and through FOIA requests. If your listeners are interested, there's a website called the Citizens Police Data Project. And it's gotten a lot of attention and was part of the context for the unfolding drama in Chicago, because it demonstrates with their data, their information, their documents, just how rare any kind of meaningful discipline is for police officers. More and more information like that needs to come out. I mean, videos, police reports, and other evidence. So insisting on transparency, on the information we need to fully get a full picture of the realities and assess the realities, so that we can be smart going forward in diagnosing those conditions and fixing them. The second broad thing is, it's a word that sounds abstract, but this notion of accountability, which really has to do with the quality of investigations of complaints of abuse, and the sort of rigor of the process of deciding whether to impose discipline on officers, and the degree of punishment, and the degree of discipline. The third thing, and in some ways this is the trickiest, and requires the most leadership within the police department, is the so-called code of silence. The culture within the department, and we saw it dramatically illustrated in the Laquan McDonald case, where, at every level, at every turn in the unfolding, from the moment when the boy is shot and bleeding out the street to the $5 million settlement that the city entered into with the family, at every point in that process, the impulse from, officers on the scene to high city officials was to circle the wagons, was to push out a false narrative. When challenged, was to double down on that narrative. And, to me, to this day, one of the most troubling things about the police response is, to the Laquan McDonald case in particular, is there were officers, the initial responders to the 911 call, that there was a young man with a knife trying to break into vehicles in this, deserted industrial area on the southwest side of Chicago. The initial responders were a couple of officers who handled the situation flawlessly. I mean, they did exactly the right thing. They asked the boy to drop the knife. He didn't. He wasn't aggressive, but he was kind of disassociated. They didn't push the issue. They called in for a taser. They didn't have one in their car. They thought maybe they would need that level of force. They didn't even call for backup. They called for somebody to come with a taser. And then they followed him, one of them driving the squad car, the other walking on the street a few strides behind Laquan McDonald. They followed him for several blocks. you know, it's definitely a law enforcement situation, required intervention. And then they, you know, come to the site where Officer Van Dyke and his partner show up, and within seconds, they blow the kid away, you know, and we've all now seen the video, and everybody yeah. knows how extreme. So I assume that those officers and the other six, seven officers on the scene, besides the shooter, you know, were as appalled as any other human being would be. There's no reason, because they're police officers, to think that they didn't respond with the same kind of horror that, and maybe more, they're on the scene. You know, they're seeing the thing as it unfolds, that so many people have the same response that so many people have had looking at the video. But then think about it, the code of silence, the kind of de facto conditions of their employment requires that they immediately turn around and lie about what they saw to protect a fellow officer. Well, those are just, I can't imagine more toxic work conditions than that. You know, the fourth broad area for reform is something you referred to before, which is the role of the police unions. Now, I am a strong supporter of unions. Police officers need union representation, you know, to ensure their compensation, their benefits, their working conditions, all of that. But the union has gone well beyond that in terms of all sorts of protections for officers who are accused of wrongdoing that really are beyond, you know, they're well beyond the due process that we as normal citizens, that, you know, the procedural rights that we as citizens have. And so there are all sorts of things that gum up investigation and in some ways really enable abuse. And so I think the city's got to go back to the bargaining table with the union. And you know, we're also looking at possible litigation strategies to challenge some union provisions on the grounds that they really do damage to the public interest and the public safety. But those are flawed. You know, so there are things we're going to learn in coming months and years, and there are innovations that are going to come. But this is one of those areas, and I think that there's a broader truth here about race in American life. We've known these things for a long time, and you can go back decades and decades, and there have been commission reports, you know, Blue Ribbon commissions, and you know, others who have inquired into these issues, who come back to the same themes and the same core reform agenda again and again. We basically know what to do, and we've known for a long time what to do, and we don't do it. And I think we have to, you know, grapple with the reasons for that. You know, I do think that one of the features of sort of these central issues and fundamental issues that are so critically and profoundly issues of race in American life is we manage to know things and not know them at the same time. You know, yes. So there's a kind of ability to deny what we know. And maybe we, you know, there's some reason to believe we've passed over a watershed in this moment, in this extended post-Ferguson moment, when denial is not an option. But I think there's also reason to be skeptical about that. I mean, I am beyond thrilled by the possibility that there's an historical opening right now for really fundamental and enduring change. But I think we also have to recognize that at various junctures in our history, we've been at similar points, and we haven't always or often risen to the challenge. So, you know, there's a lot of work ahead of all of us.
And what do you see as the role of the Department of Justice, which has recently become involved in this case?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. So, I mean, I welcome the Department of Justice coming into Chicago. It's it's overdue. There was a sufficient basis to intervene years ago, but I really welcome it. I think it's going to be the sort of linchpin, the central focus of a national effort by DOJ now to establish a sort of template for police reform. You know, Chicago is so big and history is so ugly and complicated. I think it becomes the epicenter of the larger national process. And I think the Department of Justice is going to approach it that way. My one concern about their coming in is there's a danger that the DOJ process will sort of preempt the public and social and cultural process of coming to terms with these issues. And that would be regrettable because I think, you know, and that's happened elsewhere when the Department of Justice has taken over police departments elsewhere, it kind of freezes things and they're gathering lots of information towards issuing a report a year or two after they intervene and, to inform their recommendations going forward. But that information is not reaching the public. It's not part of an ongoing process of public acknowledgement. And I think that would be a shame if that were to happen. So my hope is that there will be a sort of parallel process and that the public process, and that's what my colleagues and I are very involved in, and, you know, with our reporting and our demands for transparency, that process will inform and interact with the Department of Justice process. But I hope it doesn't shut down this really exciting, if